Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Tracy Van Slyke about the Netroots and influencing the political system. And then another two-parter, this time regarding the Super Bowl ads. The first segment will be on the much-ballyhooed Tebow ad, and the second segment will be on the outrageous sexism overall in ads this year. PBS Now took a look at clinic escorts. What was interesting is how loudly and clearly it comes through that the anti-choicers are largely motivated by both hostility to women and a perverse obsession with breaking down a woman's basic right to respect and privacy.
They went through a phase, more than one of them, of the protesters, where when women came out, they were very loudly talking about what type of procedure she may have had, taking a guess as to whether she had been under anesthesia, or whether she had had a surgical procedure, or whether she had had the type of procedure where you take pills. And then loudly and openly guessing among themselves and then calling out to patients. And, you know, that's just beyond any form of decent behavior.
It's like gossip, except meaner and more in your face and blatantly misogynist. In the run-up to the Super Bowl, there was a lot of fussing about an ad sponsored by Focus on Family that would have been about the Florida Gators quarterback Tim Tebow and his mother's claims that she was encouraged to abort the pregnancy that resulted in him. The ad itself ended up being, well, hard to really understand if you don't know much about it going in.
I call him my miracle baby. He almost didn't make it into this world. I can remember so many times when I almost lost him. It was so hard. Well, he's all grown up now, and I still worry about his health. You know, with all our family's been through, we have to be tough.
At this point, he tackles his mother, which is supposed to prove how tough she really is. The first thought I had while watching this is that someone who hadn't heard much about the controversy would assume this is just an ad about how much Pam Tebow loves her son, which is weird because don't pretty much all mothers of sons love their sons? The ad is shot on a white background and resembles the eHarmony ad so much that you'd be forgiven for thinking that this woman in the ads is Tim Tebow's wife, not his mother. But then I thought about the ad in terms of what I know about the anti-choice strategy. Mainly, by having this woman tell the story of the choice she made, they're trying to impress us with how misogynist they're not, even though they're objectively campaigning for laws that would kill millions of women worldwide. And they're even trying to imply they love women making choices, when of course Focus on the Family and the Tebows are fighting against a woman's right to choose. But they're really tone deaf about how to do this. Having a man run over his mother while she's trying to talk isn't really the best way to send home the message that you're pro-woman. In an ad that's not about restricting women's rights, that would just be cute, but in this ad it has weird overtones. But what really bothered me was that Pam Tebow brags about how tough she is. Since she's advising women to ignore their doctors when their doctors tell them pregnancy is dangerous, this is alarming. It implies that if you can't survive a dangerous pregnancy, it's because you're a wimp. On the Rachel Maddow show, Rachel made a good point about what it means to encourage women to choose to go forward with dangerous pregnancies.
I just want to make one comment about the content of this ad as reported. Everyone, of course, is very glad for Mrs. Tebow that her choice to risk her life against a doctor's advice worked out so well for her and for her family. Honestly and sincerely, it's wonderful. But she and her son and Focus on the Family and CBS, in this ad, are encouraging other women to take similar risks. As one doctor who performs abortions told the Daily Beast this week, quote, "When people want to stay pregnant no matter what the risks, we hang in there with them and do whatever we can do, whatever we can do for them. But it doesn't always turn out so well."
The innocuous nature of the ad probably protects CBS itself if someone takes this advice not to listen to your doctor seriously, But Focus on the Family is treading on some seriously unethical ground, trying to convince women to do things that risk their health, their fertility, and even their lives. If you actually follow the ad's instructions and go to the Focus on the Family's website, you'll find that things start to get really weird. Basically, it's hard to figure out what Pam Tebow's trying to say here.
I was considered high risk. I was 37. We lived in an area that didn't have great medical care at the time, and we had four healthy children, and so people questioned us, and yet we really believed that we needed to pray for Timmy, and so I did conceive, and we were very excited that I became pregnant with Timmy, and we went to see the doctor there in the town that we lived in. She said it wasn't a baby at all, he was a mass of fetal tissue, and that I needed to abort him immediately if I were going to save my life. And so...
Said it was a tumor.
But she doesn't explain why the doctor thought this. Instead, she skips right over talking about that and starts to explain why she, presumably being a God-fearing woman, decided she didn't need to live or receive decent prenatal care.
If God called me to give up my life, then he would take care of my family. And so we just trusted him, and I didn't have any more medical care at that time or any time until we moved to Manila, the capital of the Philippines, at the very end of my pregnancy.
So it's worse than even Rachel Maddow thought. They're not just encouraging women to go forward with dangerous pregnancies, but they're casting a wide net so that women with very severe conditions might believe they should. And they're encouraging women to avoid prenatal care. Well, Pam Tebow believes God rewarded her serious sacrifice by giving her Tim Tebow, who went on to win the Heisman. This is where the argument gets illogical.
And God did so many things along the way. I continued to think that I would lose him almost on a daily basis because I had such a difficult pregnancy. And yet we had a peace at the same time. So we were experiencing physical problems, but we had God's peace, and many people were praying for us, many people in the States. And I can remember one time when I'd been given some medicine to take for amoeba, and I had taken one pill. I was reading with my oldest daughter the book of Timothy, where we chose the name for our Timothy, and I just felt compelled that I needed to go and read about the medicine. And when I did, I realized that it said on the label could cause severe birth defects.
She keeps going on in this vein about how she feels God intervened to save Tim Tebow. At the end, they talk about how they discovered the placental abruption in the delivery room. Or at least that's the implication, which would mean that can't be why Pam Tebow was told to abort. We're left with an incoherent story where she was told to abort, but we don't know why. And she insists that God had a plan for Tim Tebow, and he kept saving him. Well, if God controls everything, it seems it would also be part of God's plan for women to abort if they feel that's right as well. Women who have abortions often go on to have more children or raise the ones they want or have careers and education that abortion made possible. If you think God was working through Pam Tebow, then why not working through other women who do other things besides give birth to football stars? I'd like to welcome Tracy Van Slyke to the program. Tracy is a longtime journalist and is currently the director of the Media Consortium. With fellow journalist and activist Jessica Clark, Tracy co-wrote the new book, Beyond the Echo Chamber, Reshaping Politics Through Networked Progressive Media. She's here today to talk about the book and the potential for progressive politics in the new media era. Welcome to RealityCast, Tracy.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, so obviously since you're on a podcast, you know I'm already all in on the idea that progressives should use new media to its fullest extent. But let's talk about the why anyway. Why is new media so perfect for the progressive message?
Well, in a lot of ways, what we had over the last 30 years was the conservative media really starting to dominate sort of the mainstream traditional news outlets, from radio, talk radio, to cable and broadcast. And they were really able to start dominating the message and the stories that were getting out into the mainstream. Because they had sort of this ownership and top-down dominance, of the media, the progressives had to figure out a different way of creating their own infrastructure. And the new media environment is perfect for progressives because it's a democratic, it's an open system, and it allows people to organize, collaborate, and coordinate with each other versus being told what to do and what to say. And with this new media environment, we're putting the power of what's in the hands of the people, deciding what stories are important and what stories need to have impact over the long term on our policies and politics.
Well, which is kind of interesting because you guys have a whole chapter and it's threaded through, it's threaded throughout the book about how the new media is playing watchdog to the old media, which I found interesting because the old media gripes about that a lot. They say that like the new media is parasitic, but you guys disagree. Why do you think it's so important for the new media to play the watchdog role?
Well, in the Beyond the Echo Chamber, we talk a lot about how, you know, the mainstream media isn't watchdogging itself. And the role of the new media and the network media environment really allows everyday people and independent media organizations and nonprofit and advocacy groups to play that critical watchdog role of mainstream media, of politicians, of corporations, and really sort of fact check and drive that information out to their peers and colleagues and neighbors and friends through this new media system. Once again, the new media environment is incredibly important for everyday people to be able to connect with those supposedly in power and those elite, fact check them, and spread that information out into the world.
Which, you know, gets back to the sort of title of the book. You guys are called Beyond the Echo Chamber. And of course, one of the most common complaints about new media is just that it's an echo chamber, that the only audience it reaches is people that already agree. So what do you guys have to say about that criticism?
So it's really interesting. It's like somehow in the new media environment, everyone says, oh, well, people are just going to access the information they want to access or the politics they want to access. Well, what do you think they were doing 30 years ago, or 20 years ago? I mean, people were reading the kind of news they wanted to read, but they had much more limited access to a broad swath of news. In the new media environment, not only do people have access to a diversity of news, they also now have the power to create and be part of news making, which is incredibly important and a really critical part of what we talk about in the book. I mean, the book Beyond the Echo Chamber is really about how progressive journalism organizations and to a lesser extent nonprofit organizations should really think about how to operate in this new media environment. It tracks through sort of the 2004 to 2008 and big strategies on what progressive media outlets did to impact politics and policies in this new media environment. And one of the major lessons we're seeing over and over again is that involving the audience, the users, the people that are accessing and now creating news, is critical for journalism organizations to succeed over the long term. And that's a real shift from what we saw in like sort of the right-wing echo chamber from 10, 15, 20 years ago. This sort of power in the hands of coordination between journalists and organizations and users allows a whole new way for information to be created, analyzed, and distributed. And we are seeing that really impact politics and policies over the long term. I can give you some examples if you would like that.
Yes, yeah.
So, for example, in our chapter around sort of 21st century muckraking, we analyze and tell the story about how Talking Points Memo really started involving their users and analyzing the U.S. attorney scandal. So what happened was, is Talking Points Memo, there was all these, U.S. attorneys that were fired across the country, and people were trying to figure out, well, how does this sort of connect? And Talking Points Memo started working with their community to start. So their different users and audiences from across the country started sending in stories from all over the country around, okay, my U.S. Attorney General is fired and my U.S. Attorney General is fired. So that was a starting point where Talking Points Memo was able to start using their audience as fact checkers and people who are putting the sort of the pieces together. And they were able to do that online in a way that no other mainstream organization was doing. At the same time, as more and more information came out about the U.S. attorneys and the reasons for firing them, it was a purely political, they actually helped had their audience and users start going through public and public documents. No other news organization had been able to do that before. And so with a very small staff at Talking Points Memo, combined with the strength and involvement of their users and audience and helping to do the reporting, we saw this organization drive this story into the mainstream. And if it hadn't been for them, the scandal wouldn't have been uncovered and the mainstream media would have just ignored it and let it fly by. So that's an example of really fabulous sort of beyond the echo chamber networking with your users.
So obviously this podcast and RH Reality Check is generally an organization that's for reproductive rights and justice. And
yeah.
Do you have specific ideas about how the new media could help this specific kind of message?
Well, for one, I think their RH Reality Check is doing a fabulous job of both combining reporting and sort of new media techniques. But I think it's a real challenge for journalist organizations across the spectrum, but specifically in this area, to really think about, once again, how are you using your users or involving your users in creating content and distributing content to their peers? How do you work with them to make sure that they are part of your distribution system, getting those stories out, making sure they're highlighting them to their friends and peers, and then passing that along and passing it along? That's just one basic elemental thing. The other thing is, you know, RH Reality Check is a member of the Media Consortium, which I run, which is a network of all these journalism organizations. How do you, and I think the question is, how do you start creating even smaller microcosms of new journalism organizations working together to share resources, cross-pollinate across their audiences, and really start working together to build out the overall impact of their journalism on politics and policy? And so I think that's some big stuff that could be done. And we also talk about how there's opportunities for journalism organizations and advocacy groups to start coordinating and collaborating together. We see a lot of advocacy organizations are excellent on activism and not so great in sort of providing the news and information that their constituents need. How can groups like RH Reality Check and other reproductive journalism organizations work with these advocacy groups to directly get their news and reporting that they're producing on an everyday basis to those constituents over the long term? Overall, we're going to see that sort of cross-pollination and working together in this network system is going to be the primary way that that news, information, and the right kind of messaging and action is going to move the meter on what needs to happen in the reproductive justice movement.
One thing I really liked about your book that a lot of other books about social networking and new media don't touch about is what you guys call the pale, male, and stale problem.
That's my favorite chapter. We call it Beyond PMS, but that's for short. But go on, sorry.
That's hilarious. Well, you know, I remember, like, when I first was on the internet, there was this sort of belief that we could get new media would automatically get around the problem of this sort of being dominated by the usual suspects of white guys. And obviously that hasn't panned out. So can you talk about why that is and maybe some strategies in getting around it and really why we need to get around it?
Okay. So, yeah, as you said, you know, when the internet was sort of gaining a foothold and strength and sort of influence, people said, oh, it's going to be such a democratic process because everyone has access. Well, what we've seen is sort of the white male pundits who are online tended, you know, just in a first level, start linking only to each other, you know, on a very basic level. And so if you're not part of the in crowd, it's really hard to become cool later on. And if they're not caring about issues that you find incredibly important, reproductive justice, feminism, women's rights, gender rights across the world, you're not going to be part of the cool crowd. So, I mean, that's just on one level. And this is really dangerous. For a lot of reasons, we're seeing the demographics of this country drastically changing, from the kinds of people that, from communities of color and women who are accessing, new technology and new media in different ways. And if we want to be able to reach them, we got to be able to talk about the issues, that are important to them, not just sort of the politics in DC and what we need to do about campaigns, but what's happening in their communities and in the areas that, that need to reach them. So we need to have sort of, people like you and Jessica Valenti from Feministing and the women behind Racialicious to be able to be prominent in sort of the progressive dialogue about what needs to happen with the politics and policies in our country. And because we're talking about the issues that are important to the, you know, the largest demographic in this country. And if we're cut out of the conversation, then we're going to lose this fight over the long term. At the same time, you know, we really need to think about in terms of, you know, going beyond stale is that, you know, we're seeing with Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, that humor is a really important way to access new audiences. So it's not just thinking about, okay, who are the people that need to be involved in the conversation, but also how are we producing journalism and media that's going to reach a whole new swath of audiences that are really critical to us over the long term. And that, I think, a big piece is humor, and how do we, as journalism organizations or advocacy groups, really use non-stale methods of reaching new audiences?
My guest today has been Tracy Van Slyke, and her new book with Jessica Clark is called Beyond the Echo Chamber, Reshaping Politics Through Networked Progressive Media. It's out on the New Press, and you can visit their blog at beyondtheecho.net. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Tracy.
Thanks for having me. Very exciting.
Now listen up. Now gather around. Now listen.
The Tim Tebow ad wasn't the only ad to air during the Super Bowl, as you can imagine. In fact, it was surprising to many of us that an ad that was, at the end of the day, trying to encourage women to go forward with dangerous pregnancies still managed to come across as a less misogynist ad than many that played during the Super Bowl. The big theme in a lot of ads this year was that women are all-powerful castrators who need to be resisted by buying products. There was an exhaustive amount of pro-feminist response to many of the ads on blogs and on Twitter. Guest poster Kate at Feminist rounded up some of the ads and had an interesting thesis, which is that these ads are ineffective because they're unpopular. She noted that some of the most misogynist ads were ranked the lowest on Hulu by both men and women. I was happy to see that the public at large was as hostile to the sexist ads as I was, but I'm pretty sure Madison Avenue is going to keep plunging down this road. And the reason is that you don't have to like an ad for it to work on you. In fact, products that are sold on insecurity sometimes work better if you hate the ad. Let me play an example from a universally reviled misogynist ad for the Dodge Charger.
I will take your call. I will listen to your opinion of my friends. I will listen to your friends' opinions of my friends. I will be civil to your mother. I will put the seat down. I will separate the recycling. I will carry your lip balm. I will watch your vampire TV shows with you. I will take my socks off before getting into bed. I will put my underwear in the basket. And because I do this, I will drive the car I want to drive.
The ad alarmed a lot of people because the sheer anger and hatred from the male narrator aimed at the presumed harpy of a wife who makes the target audience put his clothes in the hamper. More than a few feminist bloggers pointed out that the ad plays footsie with domestic violence before charging off into the work it out by driving fast territory. One thing is certain. The ad linked the sort of low-level boredom we all feel at having to be grown-ups to fears of emasculation and blamed it all on women, who are treated like we just love having to do household chores or something. Even if you hate this ad, the implicit argument, which is that having to do your boring work like everyone else is an assault on your manhood, may be something men reject consciously, but will creep back up when they're feeling low. And the advertisers hope that low feeling results in a car sale. But unfortunately, in many cases, men take the argument that women are to blame for all their problems seriously and end up lashing out at women. Another ad for Flow TV took a more playful tone, but it was still sexist as could be. In it, you see a guy shopping happily with his female partner, and this is presented as inexcusable behavior.
Hello, friends. We have an injury report on Jason Glaspie. As you can see, his girlfriend has removed his spine, rendering him incapable of watching the game.
Come on, silly.
Boy, that's hard to watch.
How about lavender?
How about not? Jason, get yourself the Flow TV personal television. It's live mobile TV, so now live sports goes where you go. Change out of that skirt, Jason.
This ad makes the underlying idea more explicit, which is that the advertisers don't care if you like shopping or like being with your wife. They're going to insist that you feel insecure about these things and feel emasculated, and that the only way to get over the feeling of insecurity is to buy the product. Ads like this work in the same way that hyper-skinny models in magazines work on women, by preying on insecurities. We can intellectually denounce the use of models who encourage eating disorders, but at the end of the day, the body anxiety it produces stays with us, and the marketers have products designed to alleviate that anxiety, but only for a little bit, so we will need more products. These ads I covered are misogynist, but they're also anti-male. They're there to exploit men's anxieties. There were ads that were just openly misogynist, though, like this ad for Bridgestone Tires. A car is stopped by a bunch of supervillains.
All right, here's the deal. Your Bridgestone Tires. Or your life! Wait! Stop! I said life, not wife!
Basically, when asked to choose between his tires and his life, the guy misunderstands and gleefully hands over his wife. This is less anxious masculinity and more about reaching out to male consumers on the assumption that everyone here can agree that women are awful and suck. This ad is more narrowly aimed at men who find pleasure in hating on women. The other ads prey on men who may not like the ads, but who are nonetheless made to feel insecure and uneasy. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Wow, You're Kind of Dim edition. James O'Keefe, who is trying to make a career for himself creating highly edited videos supposedly exposing mostly innocent people, and who got himself arrested allegedly trying to sabotage Senator Landrieu's office, also released a video where a male friend of his and he tried to get married, claiming they were straight with no external evidence to prove it.
You want to get married for insurance purposes?
Correct,
only.
Correct.
I mean, it's not a problem, is it?
What if two straight men wanted a same-sex marriage?
If you're not gay?
If we're not actually homosexual.
What if they were marrying each other solely for the benefits?
We're trying to get the benefits.
I think what's telling about this supposed expose is the silly belief that only same-sex marriages could work this way. Why doesn't O'Keefe think that a gay man and a lesbian could get married for benefits? Or a straight man and a woman? Or a straight person with someone gay of the opposite sex? Does he simply think it's impossible for men and women to be close enough to arrange that sort of thing without having sex? What a sad, narrow view of the world.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.